Welcome to Meet Your Neighbor, the podcast that highlights the people and stories that make Westbrook Village a truly exceptional community. I'm your host, Steve Merrilla, local realtor, neighbor, and proud member of this vibrant community. Each episode, we sit down with residents to learn about their careers, life experiences, and what brought them to Westbrook Village. It's a chance to connect, share, and celebrate the unique journeys that shape our neighborhood. Thanks for tuning in. And now, let's meet your neighbor. Today's guest is Brad Narstead. His story is one of early ambition, hard work, and lasting love. Brad knew in sixth grade that he wanted to become an attorney, a dream that never wavered. In this two-part conversation, Brad shares the inspiring journey that took him from a determined young student to a successful corporate defense attorney. He also shares a wonderful story of how he met his wife, fittingly, in law school. This is part one of our interview, where Brad reflects on the lessons he learned, the people who inspired him, and the path that shaped the life he enjoys today here in Westbrook Village. Now, let's meet your neighbor. Hey, Brad, how are you?
Good, Steve. How about you?
Great. So we got Brad here. Now, I want you to correct me if I'm wrong. So the reason I really want to interview you is because I had said before, you were given a gift that I always wanted. And I don't know if I have it right, so I'm going to say it, and you can correct me.
Okay, all right.
But the story I remember hearing was in fourth grade, an attorney came to your class. He did some kind of presentation. I assume it was bring your dad to work or something. And no one in your family was a lawyer, but you decided that day, I want to be a lawyer. And you did everything, obviously, the rest of your life to become a lawyer. Is that a true story?
Yes.
Yes.
So there's a little twist to it.
Yep.
So I grew up in Illinois, and in Illinois, in order to graduate from eighth grade, you had to pass a test on the U.S. Constitution.
Yep.
And so in sixth grade, they started, as part of the social studies program, they started introducing you to the concepts of the Constitution,
okay,
so that you could start to learn it, so that by the time you got to eighth grade and took this test, you'd pass.
You could actually pass.
Because if you didn't pass, you didn't get out of eighth grade. You had to repeat eighth grade. So their goal was to make sure you knew the information about the Constitution so you could pass this test.
So that joke about eighth grade was the best 3 years of my life was really a thing there.
Yes, because okay. It took me a while to get through that test. So when we started studying the Constitution, you know, they say that the Constitution is the law of the land. And so
right.
I thought that's what lawyers did, that they dealt with the Constitution. And,
sure.
And I thought it was a fascinating topic. So I was like, well, if that's what lawyers do, that's what I want to do.
Okay.
So, and then we did have, as part of that program, we did have lawyers who would come in and talk to us about the law and about the Constitution. And so
right.
I was like, okay, I've never met a lawyer. And I clearly didn't know what they did, right? Because
right.
I thought there are very few lawyers that deal with constitutional issues. That's
right.
A very, very small subset of the law. But that's what I thought they did. And I was like, that seems cool to me. So that's what I'm going to do. And I never thought about doing anything else.
That's incredible. Yeah. I feel like that was quite a gift that was given to you to have that decision because most of us struggle with
right.
multiple careers,
right.
Not knowing where to live, what to do, but to have that, you had that goal.
I think I got lucky.
Okay.
Because I clearly didn't know what a lawyer really did. And I didn't have anyone I could really ask because
right.
no one in my family was a lawyer, and we didn't know any lawyers, so I was blissfully ignorant about what lawyers really do. I say I got lucky because it turns out once I got to law school and figured out what I thought I wanted to do as a lawyer, it happened to fit perfectly with my personality and with what I think my skills were.
Sure.
So I got lucky because I wound up practicing law for 30 years because this sixth grade kid thought, you know, oh, lawyers deal with the Constitution. It'll be a fun thing for me to deal with.
And what did your mom and dad do?
My dad was a route salesman for Pepsi-Cola. So he drove a truck and delivered pop to grocery stores, convenience stores, and gas stations.
Okay.
And my mother was an office manager for a manufacturing company.
And how did they respond when you said, hey, I'm going to be a lawyer?
They were like, okay, great. Huh. They didn't know where that came from. They're like, all right. Neither one of my parents went to college. I have a twin sister. My twin sister and I were the first people in our family to go to college.
Oh, wow.
So they had no idea, you know. They knew that, okay, you go to college, and then I think you have to go to law school, and you have to pass a bar exam. They knew that much.
Right.
That's really all they knew. They're like, if that's what you want to do, great.
Right.
Do it.
Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah.
So did it come natural to you? I mean, or was it a lot of work? Are you a pretty intelligent guy as far as details? And
So I would say college came naturally to me.
Okay.
Law school did not. Because law school was completely different than being in undergrad, being in college.
Yeah.
I went to a very small school, 700 kids, liberal arts college in Western Illinois, Monmouth College. And I was in classes most of the time. There were four kids in the class, maybe six kids in the class. I got to know my professors very well. They would give me extra time to do exams. You know, they'd say, you know, we'd all come in for the exam, and they would, you know, pass out the blue books. You know, we'd write in the little blue books.
Sure.
And they would, some of them would literally say, my office door will be open when you're done with the test. Just put the blue books on my desk. Because they knew that I would take more, if they gave me more time, I'd take more time. That was great in undergrad. But it was it was a real
But was
problem.
It because you weren't comprehending it, or was it because you're just so detailed?
Yes, it was because I was so comprehensive that they knew that I would just keep writing and writing and writing, and so they're like, "We're not going to stop you if you if you really want to write more, we'll let you, but we're not going to wait around, right?
Sure.
So when you're done, just put it on my desk in my office, and you know I'll come back to collect it." That was a real drawback in law school. Because for a couple reasons. One, in law school, for the most part, law professors are not interested in you as a person or really as a student. They're not interested in being friendly. They teach their classes. They do their research. They write books. They write law review articles. They're not interested in a personal relationship.
Why is that? Is it because they're so into themselves? Is it ego driven, or is it a law school fundamental?
I think it's more of a they need to publish, so they have to get books published. They have to get law review articles published. That takes a lot of time outside of teaching, and so they don't really look at the student body as someone that they should become close with, they should be friends with. So it's really more of a business relationship.
Oh, okay.
That was a problem for me because I was used to being close with my professors. So it was weird that I was now in an environment where people weren't interested in me as a person.
Right. And does that affect you? You seem like a person that needs that.
Yes.
You need to be liked.
Yes.
You need, if someone gets mad at you, you probably are not too happy.
It was tough for me.
Yeah.
So that was an issue, and time was an issue. Because in law school, if you took a three-hour class, you got 3 hours for the final. If you took a four-hour class, you got 4 hours for the final. At the end of that 3 hours, you had to put your pencil down. There was no additional time. There was when you get done, just go ahead and put it in my office. So for me, coming from an environment where I was supported. People wanted to see me succeed.
Well, not to diminish what they did for you, but they babied you. They nurtured you.
Yes, there was a lot. It was a lot different than being in which was a real disservice for me because I had a very hard time my first semester of law school acclimating to that type of environment.
Well, did you think the law professors were kind of like, why don't they like me? Did you go through a point where you're trying to figure out why?
No, I think I finally realized they're just too damn busy.
They
just don't want to take the time to invest in a relationship with the students. To them, you know, they have, we had 200 and 10 kids in our first year law school class, and we were divided into three sections of 70.
Okay.
So they had, and there was one group of teachers that taught section A, there was one that taught section B, there was one that taught section C. They didn't mix. So if you were a section B professor, you knew that you had 70 kids that were, if you're teaching property, those were the 70 kids you had to make sure they learned property.
Right.
And they were more concerned about regurgitating cases and,
sure.
and making sure you could regurgitate cases than really having a relationship with people. So that was really tough for me. Law school was very tough for me.
Yeah, I bet. And how long did it take you to finish law school, and how long does it normally take?
It's 3 years.
It should take
3 years.
Okay.
So I finished in three. And I didn't really get acclimated to law school until the first semester of my second year.
Okay.
My first year,
the first two semesters were
really rough. And then I finally got the hang of it. I finally got better at reading the cases and understanding what they were looking for us
sure.
to say back. I didn't get as freaked out when I would go into an exam. By that point in time, you know, I had 10 exams under my belt, and I kind of knew what to expect and
sure.
what the professor was looking for. So, but it took me a good year to get my feet acclimated and figure out, you know, how am I going to make this work?
Was that scary for you?
It was. It was very scary.
Yeah, because your whole life, I'm going to be a lawyer, and you get
right.
to law school, and you're like,
maybe not.
Nobody likes me. Yeah.
Maybe I'm not going to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
Maybe this isn't going to work out the way I expected.
So, your wife is also an attorney?
She is.
Where did you guys meet?
At law school.
At
University
law school?
Of Illinois
okay.
College of Law.
The first year when you were struggling?
We met within the first week.
Oh, really?
The first week.
And just knew it. Was it like being a lawyer? You just knew you were going to be her husband?
Well, I did. When I met her, I tell her this. She has a slightly... We have a slightly different version of how we first met.
Okay.
And I tell her, I'm certain that it's how I remember, because when I met you, my first thought was, that's the woman I'm going to marry.
Okay.
I mean, as soon as I met her. She didn't have that same thought. So I said, I don't think you remember exactly, you know, what that first meeting was like, where it was. But we both lived, she went to the University of Iowa did her undergraduate
okay.
work at the University
yep.
of Iowa. And she had never been to Illinois, the University of Illinois, before she set foot on campus to start law school. Nor had I.
All right, so you're both newbies.
And so we both, we didn't know the market, right, the apartment market and everything in Champaign. So we both took the easy way out. We said, we're both just going to get a room in a graduate residence hall.
Yeah.
So we lived in a graduate residence hall our first year. And what we didn't realize when we made those arrangements, the graduate residence hall did not have a dining facility. So in order to eat, we had to go to an undergraduate residence hall in order to eat.
Right.
And there were, I think, 9 first-year law students that lived in Sherman Hall. That was the name of the graduate residence hall. So all 9 of us would go to eat together because we'd have to walk
sure.
to this undergraduate residence hall in order to eat. So we ate every meal together. We walked over there together. We walked back together. So the 9 of us knew each other very well. And so that's how we both lived in Sherman Hall. We both had to go to this dining hall to eat, and that's how we started hanging out. We were not, by the way, because maybe you were going to ask this question, Steve, but we were not in the same section.
Okay.
So I was in section B, she was in section C.
So you weren't taking the same classes.
We were taking the same classes,
but different
all three sections
gotcha.
Take the same courses. They're just taught by different professors. And you don't really, that first year, you don't really mix.
Okay.
The Section C people spent all their time together. Section B people spent all their time together. Section A people spent
But
all
you
their
had
time
this residential
yes.
relationship.
Yes.
So let me ask you, don't try and guess the questions I'm going to ask
okay.
you.
Okay.
I know you're smarter than me, but what I was going to ask is, in that group of 9, as you're starting to develop this relationship with this woman that you're going to marry, that you know you're going to marry instantly, Did other people in that group know before your wife knew? You know, did some of the seven see it? Because I got to think you started gravitating towards each other. Yes. You were walking with them, yes, but you're dragging behind. Like, hey, come on back here. I want to hold your hand.
There was one guy who knew that something was up.
Okay.
The others, not so much. They didn't claim to be surprised once we started dating, but the one guy,
he said, he saw it coming.
When we finally started going out, he was like, oh, I saw this. I knew this from, you know, day right. one. I knew yeah. that this was going
to
happen.
So it was yeah. obvious to him. He was, yeah. So you get through law school together. She graduated in 3 years also?
Same time.
Okay. And then what kind of law did you go into?
So I wound up trying cases for insurance companies and corporations.
Okay.
Civil lawsuits.
Yep.
So
you were defending the big corporations.
Yep. Yes.
Okay.
And Deb went to work for originally Amoco, which then became British Petroleum.
Okay.
And she spent 30 years with British Petroleum. But the time that she retired, she was in charge of all of their labor and employment and immigration attorneys in the Western Hemisphere.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
she's a big deal.
She was, I far out kicked my coverage.
Really? Did you, well, that wasn't hard. And did you stick with that corporate?
Yeah.
Okay,
so that was
your career.
I did that for 28 years. I tried cases for General Electric, Costco, CBS Corporation, Progressive Insurance.
Wow, so you
Allstate
had some
insurance.
Big deal customers.
I had a lot of, and I tried high stakes cases for them in state and federal courts around the country.
Wow.
So mostly in Illinois, but I would from time to time be asked to handle cases in other jurisdictions, other states.
That had to feel pretty satisfying.
It was, especially because I did not intend to be a trial lawyer.
Really?
That is not what I ever envisioned doing. I wound up, I got lucky.
Yeah.
So I got a job with this firm between my second and third year of law school. It was an 80 lawyer trial firm in Chicago.
Yeah.
And I took the job with them because they did the type of work that I was interested in. They did tort work, the personal injury kind of work. And I didn't think that I would be a good trial lawyer. So I thought, okay, I'll take this summer job with them. Hopefully they'll give me a permanent job. I'll stay there for a couple years. No lawyer ever tries a case within the first couple years. It just doesn't happen.
Sure.
So I'll learn some stuff and then I'll go do something else. I'll find, you know, whatever it is I want to do, I'll go do something else. And I wound up through a weird series of events that I won't share. I wound up working for the guy that founded the firm. So the firm was called Williams, Montgomery & John, and I wound up working for Lloyd Williams.
So when you say working for him, what were you?
I was
you
assigned
his,
to him.
Okay, you were assigned to him.
I was
as
basically his guy.
Yeah.
I was his right hand man.
Okay.
So he
wanted
something
done.
Say,
you're
he
the
would
guy.
Basically say, you go prepare the case, take the depositions, retain the experts, answer the discovery, do all the things that needs to be done. And if the case needs to be tried, I'll step in at the last minute and I'll try the case.
Okay.
You'll try it with me, but I'll be the main trial lawyer.
And this is when you're still in graduate school, right?
No, this was after I had graduated.
Okay.
I wound up
so you're now an attorney.
Getting assigned to him.
Yep.
He was hands down, if you would have asked in the 90s and into the 2000s, you would have asked anybody in the city of Chicago, I want you to tell me give me a list of the 10 best defense trial lawyers in the city of Chicago. Lloyd would have been at the top of that list.
Oh, wow.
On anybody's list.
Sure.
He was
did you know that at the time?
I did only because people had told me when I wound up getting assigned to him. They're like, I can't believe that you got assigned to this guy. Again, I
How
was
lucky
really lucky.
Yeah,
I was really lucky.
Yeah,
because
I was lucky when I met my wife.
He was a phenomenal trial lawyer. So I learned to try cases from one of the best people in the city. And I realized after a while that I was actually good at it.
Sure.
And I liked doing it, so I was like, well, I'll just keep doing it. And so then 28 years later.
So what do you like? So I just want to dig into that a little bit, just because I'm curious. So you like the trial part of it? You like being on stage when it's time to argue the case?
Yes.
Or do you like the detail? Because it seems like back in when you were in school, you loved the comprehensive part of the law. You loved digging in detail after detail after detail. Was that part of it, or was it?
That was
now
part
I get
of
to
it.
Now I get to get on stage and show my work.
But I think for me the big part was, a trial is like a chess match.
Okay.
And you need to try and think 3 or 4 steps ahead. What do I need to do to get this piece of evidence in? What do I need to do to bar that witness from testifying? What my goal all the time, my goal when I would get in a case was, if it was when I was working for Lloyd, and eventually I became a partner and Lloyd was like, you know, you don't need me anymore, right? You're on your own. You're the guy. You get associates to work for you now, right? And you train
awesome.
The next generation
yep.
of lawyers. My goal, anytime I had a case, I would look at the case and I would say, what do I need to do to win this case without going to trial? So, can I get the case dismissed on a motion for dismissal? Can I get judgment entered for my client and a motion for summary judgment, which is basically you put all the evidence out there for the judge and they decide it without having to go to trial?
Right.
That was always my goal. How can I get rid of the case either on a motion to dismiss or a motion for summary judgment so my client doesn't have to pay for the expense of actually trying the case? But
in doing that, if you did go to court, you had such a strong case.
Yes.
Because you did all your work.
Yes.
So just a combination of the two.
What you had to, although that was my game plan, you always had to make sure that if necessary, you could try the case.
Right.
If because sometimes a plaintiff would say, I might evaluate a case and say, all right, yeah, the defendant probably bears some liability, but I think that the case is worth $200,000. Best day, right? Jury's going to give the plaintiff $200,000. And the plaintiff might come back and say, our demand is $2 million, and we're not going to take a penny less than $2 million. So then the client and I are like, okay, well, if that's the case, then we have to try the case, right? Because
right.
You're not willing to pay $2 million. They're not willing to accept $200,000. So we're going to have to ask 12 people sitting in a jury box,
yep.
Who do you think is right?
And now that $200,000 that they were going to offer is going in Brad's pocket.
Yes, it is.
that's kind of a good little gig.
That's a good. The beautiful part about being a defense attorney is I always got paid, right?
Yeah.
Because I billed by the hour.
Right.
And I sent a bill out
You're
every month.
You're not taking that percentage and the gamble.
Right. The plaintiff's attorneys are gambling, right? If I win, I'm going to take a third. But if they don't win, they get zero. So
right.
I always got paid. That was the beautiful part about being a defense attorney, because I always knew that I was going to get paid.
Right. You weren't taking any. Did you take any cases that were pro bono? Did you do any work like that? Did you do any good?
No, I'm kidding. Wow. I would like to think, talk to the people at CBS, they tell you I did a lot of good.
No, and I say that in jest
I know
that, you know, anytime there's a, you know, Target has a target on its back, right? Costco has a target on its back. If you, there's a lot of malicious lawsuits against big corporations. So I do say that in jest. But did you do it? I mean, you obviously felt good about what you did overall in your career, because you were helping save money, you were enforcing the law of the land like you originally started.
Yep.
Didn't know what you were doing when you started, didn't know how meaningless that meant. But did you have any cases that were sentimental to you that you felt you had to take? Or I mean, maybe it just doesn't apply to what kind of law you did.
I don't
need to sound smarter.
Because there's, that's a good question, Steve, because people, when they hear that you represented or that you defended corporations, they're like, oh, you know, you're defending this big bad corporation. But what I always tell people is, but that corporation is made up of people.
Right.
Right? And so
absolutely.
So there were people who were being accused of being negligent, of doing something that caused somebody harm. that bothers them, right? Nobody wants somebody to say, oh, well, you know, you messed up, and because of that, you know, somebody lost a leg, or, you know, they can no longer see, or, you know, so.
Right.
So I always tried to remind people that it's not a nebulous corporation. There are real people that make up that corporation and that are being accused of doing bad things, and they're entitled to a defense just like anybody else is. And I would often be very invested in a case because of the people that I was actually representing, right? The people that were really the ones that were being accused of, well, you did this wrong, you did that wrong, you didn't make this product safe, you could have done this differently. And sometimes that was the case. I mean, I don't want to...
Right. Everybody makes mistakes. And
absolutely.
I guess what I'm... You know, I've never thought of it because I've never interviewed you before. But you were defending the people at those companies, let's put it that way, from mistakes they made and other lawyers thinking that's a lottery ticket.
Right.
And that's what... It's about fairness.
Yes.
It's about the fairness for the punishment for the mistake you made or the bad decision you made. And if it's malicious, you're going to pay. You're going to end up...
it's funny that you use that word fairness, because anytime I would make a closing argument to a jury, one of the things I would always say is you have to keep in mind that we believe that the defense is not liable and you should return a not guilty verdict. But if you believe that the defense is liable and the plaintiff is entitled to compensation, you need to keep in mind that compensation needs to be fair to both sides.
Right.
It's not just, you know, how much money can we give the plaintiff? It's how much is actually fair to compensate them. Not, as you said, this isn't a lottery ticket, right? It's not, okay, you've hit the mother load, you happen to get injured, and now we're going to give you a check with, you know, 9 zeros on it. It needs to be fair to both sides. And a lot of times that was missing in the equation. And so I tried to always remind the people in the jury that, you know, we think we've proved our case. We think we've proved that, you know, the defendant's not liable. But if you believe otherwise, you have to make sure that your verdict is fair to both sides.
Did you ever get an unfair verdict that you thought was out of line?
Yes.
And yeah.
Yes.
Did that hurt?
It did. It was actually, it was the first case that I ever helped to try. I was a very young lawyer. I think I was a second year lawyer. And it was a case involving a young girl who, and this will tell you, so I have handled over the course of my career thousands of cases. Wow. But I remember the name. This case, that's why it stuck with me. The young girl's name was Catherine Saksewski, and she was born at Northwestern Memorial Hospital, and she had a birth injury. When she was delivered, she had her shoulder got stuck in the birth canal.
Okay.
And when she was delivered, she wound up with a case of cerebral palsy. Not a severe case of cerebral palsy, but she clearly was injured. She was injured in the
birthing process.
The guy that I was working with on this trial and I were representing Northwestern Memorial Hospital and the nurses that were involved in the delivery. And we believed that there was no negligence in the birth. The jury disagreed and returned a verdict in that case in excess of $6.5 million.
Wow.
That was in 1993, which at that time was an exorbitant amount of money. I mean, we were absolutely shocked when they came back with that verdict. And it went up on appeal. We did not win the appeal. And Northwestern wound up, you know, having to pay that verdict. And it was very... it was traumatic because we thought that we had a winning case, and B, it was an enormous amount of money. I mean, it was, outside the realm when we roundtabled
the case.
It set
records.
It did.
Yeah.
It made the front page of the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin, which is the daily newspaper for the legal profession in Chicago.
Wow.
Because people were like, "Oh my God!"
Really?
When we roundtabled the case before it went to trial, you know, we would ask people, you know, assuming that they find in favor of the plaintiff, you know, what's the top dollar? What's the most that you think they'll get? We had one person who told us $3 million, and we thought they were insane. We were like, $3 million? No way! And so when it came back at 6.5, we were like, oh my God, that one really stuck with me.
Wow.
Because it was a big verdict, and I'm not going to say that she wasn't injured. She was injured, but not to that extent.
But the liability, how do you put $6.5 million?
Yeah. That was the first time that I really understood that sometimes jurors, even though they're told not to, jurors do not ignore their sympathy.
Sure.
They saw a little girl,
yep,
who, you know, had limited use of her arm.
Yep.
And they said, you know what, we're gonna compensate her, and boy, did they compensate her.
Did you learn a lot from that? I mean, did it affect you in future cases on just the just the emotional chances you take in that?
Yes, and what I really learned was, you just never know what 12 people are gonna do.
Yeah.
Because you think, and I'll give you the flip side of that, Steve. I also had cases that I took to trial that I told the client, there's no way we're going to win, right? The goal in this case is to keep the verdict as low as possible, and we wound up getting a not guilty. And so what I really learned was, you just don't know what 12 ordinary people who are sitting in that jury box are going to do.
But what does that say about the? I mean, I don't want to get into it. I mean, we're at our limit for the interview already, and I haven't
can't believe that
peeled this onion. But what does that say about the legal system? I mean, is it flawed, or is it? Do you look at it as the total number of cases, and we're getting a majority of them right?
I still think that our system is the best system.
Yeah.
And I think that 99% of the time, the jury gets it right.
Okay.
I think there are aberrations, and by the way, aberrations on both sides.
Oh,
not just plaintiffs getting huge verdicts, but I think sometimes defendants get verdicts that they shouldn't have gotten. But I think 99% of the time the jurors get it right.
Okay.
I think they do the right thing. They take the time to listen to the case. They listen to the evidence. They read the jury instructions. They listen to what the judge tells them. And I think almost all the time, they reach the right decision.
All right. I'll give you that then. I mean, you know better than me, 1,000 cases. That means 1 out of 100, you had how many go bad? 10 that went the opposite.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a pretty good batting average.
Yeah, not bad.
We're going to end legal talk because I find it fascinating. And I know that I've heard that you've written books, and I'd like to review that in a second podcast.
Sure.
But I like to keep these at 30 minutes, but I want to talk a little, just touch briefly on, how'd you find Westbrook? I mean, you live in Westbrook. This is Meet Your Neighbor.
Yeah.
How did you find Westbrook from coming from?
Completely by accident.
Really?
So we were looking for a winter place.
Yep.
We were looking for it during COVID.
Oh,
right?
Perfect
so,
time shot.
So we weren't able to get on a plane. We'd never been in this area. We had a son who went to the University of Arizona, so we had spent time in Tucson. But we knew we didn't want to be in Tucson. So that son, after he graduated from Arizona, went to Chicago, and then he came back, and he moved to Scottsdale. So we were like, all right, well, we don't want to buy a place in Scottsdale, a little too pricey. So let's...
Right.
So my wife started looking, and we knew we wanted a place that had amenities, right, that had...
And Westbrook does.
Pools and clubs and all that stuff. And so we started looking at places, and we were looking at Sun City, and my wife has a cousin who lives here, and she said, you don't want to go to Sun City. It's old. You guys would not fit in there. So she asked her cousin, well, is there a place, you know, a 55 plus community that, you know, has, she's like, well, I've heard a lot of people that have moved to Westbrook Village said it's really nice. Look there. So she looked online and she was like, this place looks really nice. And so we, I swear, bought our place without ever setting foot in it.
Really? Are you happy?
Love it. Almost every day we say, again, boy, did we get lucky.
Yeah.
We love all of Westbrook. We love the neighborhood that we live in. We've got great neighbors. It's very convenient. Right off the 101, you can get really anywhere within, 35, 40 minutes. It's beautiful.
Yeah, they do a great job. I mean, everyone hates HOAs, but our HOA keeps the neighborhood value and the community.
Phenomenal job. We cannot get over how we really did luck out that we, without having set foot in the place.
Do you, is pickleball your favorite thing to do in Westbrook?
That's my favorite thing to do.
Do you think you'll ever get better?
I maybe in another year or two. I'm hoping to get a little bit better.
Yeah, you're still an undergraduate when it comes to pickleball, just so you know. Yeah, I love pickleball. I love the whole community. So, I love playing pickleball against you. I still have marks from last time we played, don't worry.
It's only because I'm not that good yet. I can't figure out how to get the ball.
We're going to agree to have another podcast because I want to hear more about you being an author. I love talking to smart people. I'll hopefully find one someday. But it was just a joke. Go ahead. You can laugh. All right. You good?
Yep.
All right.
Thanks, Steve.
Hey, thank you, man. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
See you. Thank you for listening to the Meet Your Neighbor podcast. If you enjoyed today's conversation, be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And feel free to share this podcast with friends and fellow neighbors. Until next time, take care and keep connecting.